Om Kataksha Kirana Chanta Naman Moha Taye Namaha Anantananda Krishnaya Jagan Mangala Murtiye.
Let's start with 22, because this is kind of a set, starting with 22.
You know, we did 22.
I know. We're just going to chant 22 and 23.
Oh,
Swarupameva me sattvam natu dharmo nabastavad badanyasya sato bhavat nahi sajjatirishyate Swarupameva me jnanam nadgunasnas guno yadi anatma twamasattvam va jneya jneya twayopate.
Again.
Swarupameva me jnanam nagunasa guno yadi anatma twamasattvam va jneya jneya twayopate.
Okay. Swarupam eva me jnanam na gunaha sa guno yadi gunaha yadi saha gunaha yadi. Okay. Anatma twam asattvam va jneya ajneya twayoho patate. Swarupam eva me jnanam, all in the nominatives, neuter. Jnanam, knowledge, is indeed my swarupa, is my nature. Jnanam is swarupa, my own nature, is indeed eva's emphasis. Swarupam eva me jnanam, knowledge is indeed my swarupa. Na gunaha, it is not a guna. We have like three things here. Knowledge alone is my swarupa, it's my nature. Na gunaha, it is not a guna. Na gunaha, it is not a quality. Sagunaha yadi, if that is a guna, sagunaha, that is a guna. You have to bring in the asti. If it is a guna, right? So what does that mean? If knowledge is a quality. So knowledge alone is my swarupa, is my nature. It is not a quality, nagunaha. Yadi, if that were a guna, if that is a guna. In English, we just say, if it were a quality. Literally, it says, if it is a quality, right? Then what? Anatmatvam asatvam va. Anatmatvam, being not the self. The twam, right? The state of being anatma. Anatmatvam. Remember, twam is that state of being. The twam affix. So the anatmatvam, the state of not being the being not the self, being the anatma, being anatma. Va or asatvam, non-existent. The state of being non-existent. The state of being anatma or the state of being non-existent. Okay? Now we're going to have to bring in this genitive. This dwandva genitive. Jneya ajneya twayoho. Genitive dual. For that which is jneya, an object of knowledge, for that which is known, that's a potential participle, means that which can be known, that which is able to be known, that which is knowable. Knowable, able to be known, can be known, is jneya. Ajneya is that which cannot be known, cannot be objectified, right? It's not an object of knowledge. So jneya, ajneya, twa, yoho. Now, when you have a twam, like in the first one, anatmatvam and asatvam, then the anatmatvam and the asatvam are going to be referring to, they're going to be in relationship to something that's put in the genitive. So here, you've got two, the anatmatvam, asatvam va, either this or that, for either this or that. okay, in the genitive. So there would be, so take the first anatmatvam. The first anatmatvam would go with jnaya, jnayasya. There would be the state of not being the self for it if it were to be, were known. You see, if it's a guna, because, so you take this first line, jnanam is my swarupa, it's not a guna. If it were a guna, then is understood, then what? Then it would be, what would be the jnanam, would be anatma. If it, for that which is something that can be, if it can be objectified, jnaya, if it is jnaya, right, then it would be anatma, because it can be objectified. Anatmatvam jnayasya, if I break this compound. If it is something that can be objectified, then that makes it anatma, because it's an object of knowledge. If it is ajnaya, if it can't be objectified, then it doesn't exist. It's asatvam. And notice here the jnaya and ajnaya means it cannot be that. It's unable to. Like ajnaya, it's unable to be objectified. It cannot be objectified. Potential participle. Jnaya, it is able to be objectified. It is objectifiable. It is not objectifiable. It is knowable. It is not knowable. Okay? So here, so here's the logic. Again, going back to the teaching methodology of, say, the Drik Drishya Viveka. What the Drik Drishya Seer Drik Drishya Seen, that which Drishya, potential participle, that which can be seen. So the Drik is the subject, the seer, and the Drishya is anything which can be seen, anything that can be objectified. So when we do that discrimination between the Drik and the Drishya, the seer and the seen, we're differentiating, making a differentiation between those two. What happens as we do that differentiation is that once something can be objectified, once you objectify it, means I am aware of it, that act of objectification brings that thing objectified into the state of being anatma. Because what the problem that I have as a jiva, say when we're just starting out, you don't have any knowledge, you come to the teacher and you ask, who am I? The problem is that I know that I am, I exist, I'm a sentient being, but I take this sentiency, this conscious being that I am, to be this body. And that's what we call anyonya adhyasa. The ajnanam, the ignorance, causes the effect of ignorance, of ajnanam, atma, you know, atma ajnanam, atma ajnanam, self-ignorance. The effect of that is anyonya adhyasa, mutual superimposition, where I take myself to be something which is in fact objectified. But from the standpoint of the mind, the antakarana has always taken itself to be a conscious being. That's the ignorance, beginningless ignorance. It always takes itself to be a conscious being because itself, being sattva, when it is up, when it is functioning, it is never away from consciousness. So whatever the vritti is, that vritti enjoys consciousness. So why should the antakarana not say, I'm a conscious being? And then it also sees that it is, you know, abiding in this body via the sense organs. So all the what we call the kardiyakarana sangata, the body-mind sense organ complex, is becomes an upadhi for consciousness. Because sense consciousness pervades it, and from its standpoint, you know, for it to be, when it is a conscious being. There's no way from its standpoint to differentiate or any need to differentiate the two. And so the body-mind sense organs takes itself to be a conscious being. So I am the conscious being. And by doing, it becomes the conscious being by that ajnanam. And the conscious being becomes limited by the body-mind sense organs. So that's why mutual anyonya adhyasa. This superimposition is only really from the standpoint of the mind. From the standpoint of consciousness, there's only consciousness. So this doesn't apply. Ajnanam really only applies from the standpoint of the upadhi, from the standpoint of the mind. And so in the whole teaching methodology, what we're doing is differentiating consciousness from anything that can be objectified.
So mind's called an object.
Just yeah. In the Drik Drisha, anything that can be objectified, right, becomes anatma by the very fact that there's a seer seen, a Drik Drisha relationship between the two. Now, when you recognize a Drik Drisha, seer seen relationship, there's some things in addition to just the fact that you're objectifying it that show that there's, and what we call asangatvam, that there is no attachment, no relationship really between the Drik and the Drisha. There's no, it's asanga, there's no attachment. And the reason is because once you can differentiate and objectify something, you recognize that whatever is objectified can go through a process of change without you going through a process of change. For instance, when you objectify the mind, you notice that a thought comes and it goes. The thought continues to modify. You remain there before, during, and after any type of modification, any type of change. When that's the case, when you remain and the modifying, whatever is modifying, is continually changing without your changing, there can be no real relationship. Because otherwise, when this thing changes, you would also be gone. What has changed is gone now. So you would be gone. So with that Drik Drisha, what happens is what you have taken to be yourself, the Atma, like the mind says, I am the Atma, or I am the body, or, you know, I am the seer, I am the hearer. What you have taken to be yourself is now shown clearly to be an Atma, not yourself. This is not me, because this is not only objectified, but being objectified, I am the witness of its coming and going. See what I mean? So here, what he says is, if knowledge, if consciousness, he says, consciousness is my swarupa. It's not a guna. It's not a quality. If it's a quality, which would mean that I am something, and then this something has the quality of consciousness, right? And so the substantive, the substance is different and actually supports the existence of the quality. If that's the case, if consciousness is a quality of me, right, then it becomes, being a quality, it becomes anatma, you know? Because if it can be known, if the consciousness can be known by me, then it becomes a quality, right? If it can be known. But now, if the consciousness, so how does he say this? So, swarupameva jnanam nagunaha sagunaha yadi anatmatvam, the anatmatvam nyayasya. So there's anatmatvam of that which can be known. So is consciousness going to be objectified? You know, that's one way of taking it. I'm going to take it in another way in a minute. Anatmatvam. So so anatmatvam of what can be known, because anything that can be objectified becomes anatma, because it's separate, it's differentiated from the conscious being that's objectifying it. But then if you say it's agnyeya, it cannot be objectified, the consciousness cannot be objectified, agnyeyatva, then it's a set, then it doesn't exist, neither of which makes any sense. Now this is the thing, you say it's a guna, and it can be objectified, then it's anatma. If you say no, it can't be objectified, then it's asatva, it doesn't exist. Because it's a guna, but it can't be objectified, then there's no such thing. Because if it can't be objectified in the basha, you say it's like the horn of a rabbit or the son of a barren woman. Because the thing, if something exists, okay, this is actually a nice thing. In the creation, We can call the creation, the whole manifest creation, as nama-rupa. If something has no nama-rupa, it's not there. But you have to understand nama-rupa, like even a sound is nama-rupa. You know, a concept is nama-rupa, name form. Mm. Why we say that is because anything in the creation, whatever it is, if it can in any way be differentiated from something else, then it's a nama-rupa. Because the other things that exist differentiate this thing. So on any level, unless it's totally free of nama-rupa, if it's free of nama-rupa, then there's nothing, then it's not here. See what I mean? Do you understand? If it is not objectifiable, means there's nothing there to be differentiated from something else. It can't be known. It's not saying that you can know it. Because what if it's on another loka? You know, or what if we don't have instruments to objectify it? But if we had the instruments to objectify it, because it is there as an object to be objectified. So if you have the instruments to objectify it, or if you're in the vicinity with which where you're able to objectify it, then you can know it. So the thing is able to be known because it has a nama rupa in the sense that it can be differentiated from something else in the creation. If it can't be objectified, then it doesn't exist. Because it has no nama-rupa, it has no, there is nothing there that is knowable. And so then, like the horn of a rabbit or the son of a barren woman, there's nothing there. And so if you say that consciousness is objectifiable, it's a guna, you say it's a guna, it's a quality. If it's objectifiable, then it's anatma. If you say it's not objectifiable, and you say it's a guna, then where is it? It doesn't exist. It's a guna, but it's not objectifiable. And so it has no being in samsara. It has no being at all in duality. So in this way, there's something that's nice to understand here. There's the creation, and everything in the creation by its nature, by mind, it is objectifiable. If it is, it's objectifiable. That's its nature, because it's a quality, or it's a guna, or it's something that has for its being consciousness. Because it has its being as consciousness, it can be known. It can be objectified. So that takes care of the creation. Subjective creation is objectifiable, and therefore it is knowable. There's only one other thing that is gnayam. There's only one thing I would say that is gnayam, that is able to be known, that is not objectifiable. And that is consciousness itself. Right? Consciousness itself is known because its swarupa is consciousness. Consciousness is the only thing that doesn't require objectification. That's why we say consciousness itself is aparoksha. When we say consciousness is aparoksha, we're talking about that in two different ways. Consciousness is, and let me just, for some of you, just explain aparoksha. In terms of our means of knowledge that we have available to us, we divide the means of knowledge into two basic categories. Pratyaksha, that which is immediately available to our sense perception. Through our sense organs, we have direct cognition. That's pratyaksha. Paroksha is that which is not immediately available to our sense perception. So in one sense, all of the other pramanas, like inference and presumption and shabda pramana, all of these fall in within the world into paroksha. Because, for instance, if I say, there's a fire on the hill, see the smoke. What is pratyaksha is the smoke. I mean, it is the smoke. The fire is paroksha, actually. I'm not actually seeing the fire. But there's an invariable relationship between the smoke and the fire, right? So that it becomes another means of knowledge that we have available to us, which is dependent on pratyaksha, sense perception. Whether it be inference or presumption. Presumption is if I wake up in the morning and I see everything is just covered, mud puddles of water all over. I don't see, it's not raining, it's sunny, but I, because of the situation, I can presume that it rained last night, even though I'm not experiencing the rain. So that's paroksha. So we have these things, we have the pratyeksha immediately available to my sense perception, or even certain types of vrittis are considered pratyeksha. It's called sakshi pratyeksha, like any emotion that you have. Or an imagination that's not being generated by the sense organs, but the emotion arises, and as a sakshi, you illumine that emotion. It's a direct, immediate experience. Imagination, memories coming in, they're sakshi. They're sakshi pratyeksha. They're immediately known. Okay? But all of these others are not immediately known, like inference, and also if I don't see an elephant in the room. I'm not seeing the absence of the elephant. I'm seeing the rug. Right? So there's another means of knowledge that's involved here. So these are in samsara, in duality, these are the means of knowledge that we have. They're either pratyeksha or they're paroksha. They're once removed. Aksha means eyes. So they're once removed, right? They're away from the eyes. They're away from the sense organs, right? Mm-hmm. Prati aksha. Prati means they're in the vicinity of the sense organs. Para aksha, they're away from the eyes. Aksha standing for all the sense organs. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's what we did. So there's six major means of knowledge. It's a study. It's an important study, actually. But here, for our purposes, in the world, we can, through our means of knowledge, we can know the things that are immediately available to our sense perception, or the things that we can deduce through inference, presumption, these type of things. So there's six major means. But knowledge of yourself is not pratyeksha. You don't illumine awareness through the sense organs, all right? I'm not looking at some awareness over here. That's for pratyeksha, where through my sense organs I perceive an object. And it's not paroksha, right? It's I don't infer, because there's no object to infer off of. I don't presume, because there's no object in the world to presume off of. And so, and also, I'm not away from myself. I can't be objectified pratyeksha by the sense organs, but I'm not removed from myself. There's no distance between me and me. Okay? And there's also no distance between me and the sense organs. It's just that the sense organs can't objectify me. So what we say then is that I am the Atma, the self, is not paroksha, it's not pratyeksha, that's not how it's known. It's not indirect knowledge of paroksha, it's a paroksha. Means it's not indirect. It's not pratyeksha, right? But it's not paroksha either. Mm-hmm. So we say it's a paroksha. It's not paroksha, it's not pratyeksha, but it's not paroksha either. Why? Because consciousness itself is what we call swata siddha. It's self-evident. It's swaprakashatvam. It's self-shining, right? Self-evident, self-shining. And so that means that consciousness is its own experience. It is your bottom line. It is the self-shining me being that is always present. Now, that fact is something true for you whether or not you have knowledge. For a jnani and an ajnani, it's a given. That means, and that's what we call the aparokshatvam of the Atma, which is what we will call sadhanana jnanam. It is the aparoksha jnanam, sadhananam, sadhanana aparoksha jnanam. It's that direct, immediate self-recognition that is generally understood and taken for granted by all beings, really. And so it manifests in the form of every one of us being able to say, oh yes, I am, I exist. Yes, I'm an awareful being, Yes, I'm awareful, I have awareness, I exist. The existence, the awareness that you're referring to, is not an object that you're looking at. It is the very nature of your being. And so, in fact, the Atma that you take for granted, that Atma is Brahman, which you don't know. The Atma that you take to be yourself is the Brahman, which you have not recognized. What you do recognize is just the bottom line of yourself. I am an existent conscious being. And that existent conscious being that you totally take for granted, and then because of the anyonyam and anyonya adhyasa, you take to be the body, mind, sense organs. But the whole, what has to happen is that that very conscious being that you already take to be you, you know, it's not like you don't take it to be you. You already take it to be you. It's like the pot saying, I am the clay. You say, I am the conscious being. You take it to be you, and it is you. It's just that you have superimposed yourself upon all of the upadis, the body, the mind, the sense organs. Upadi means anything that can be mistaken as me. That's an upadi. You can call it conditioning agent. And so it's not that you're wrong about who you are. You know, in general, your own self-experience, it's that because of self-ignorance, you've lassoed, you know, which we call the hridaya granthi, the knot of the heart. Because of the ajnanam, you've lassoed all of these upadis onto yourself. Like, I am. Now, if you just stop there, you'd be perfect. I am. But it doesn't stop. I am the mind. I am my thoughts. I am my emotions. I am my perceptions. You know, I am the quality of my sense organs. I am my physical body and whatever its qualities are. And so that's the anyonya adhyasa that's brought about by ignorance. Because
and that's
from,
so very true.
Because from the standpoint of the upadis, they recognize themselves as consciousness, just like the pot would say, I am clay. It is clay. It's not mistaken. It is clay. Half of the equation is perfect. You know, and so when my mind says, I am a conscious being, that's like the pot saying, I am clay. There's no mistake there. Its very self is the conscious being me. But what it doesn't recognize is the other side of the equation. And to make that other side of the equation understood, we need this drik drisha viveka. So hold that to get back to the aparoksha. So there's two forms here of aparoksha. That's where I was starting. The first is just the natural recognition of yourself as a conscious being, which is not something, which knowledge is not gained through any type of objectification, nor is it an indirect knowledge, like somebody told me I was a conscious being. You know, so it's a direct, immediate recognition that doesn't involve duality, because yourself is self-shining. So we say your self-recognition is aparoksha. It doesn't require any type of objectification. But you can still be an ajnani with that. Because just generally, as the sadhana jnanam, I am a conscious being. Not objectifiable, just a fact. My own self-experience, self-shining experience. But usually when we're using the word aparoksha, we're using it in terms of aparoksha jnanam. I can say the Atma is aparoksha, perfect. But now we're talking about aparoksha jnanam. How does self-knowledge take place? It does not take place in the same way that knowledge of an object takes place. So for knowledge of an object, either my sense organs or another means of knowledge, what has to happen is first I have to gain the experience of the object. And gaining the experience of the object, then being illumined by consciousness, it is known. So for instance, this painting I have through pratyaksha, my sense perception, I now have, because I'm looking at that painting, I have a vritti, a thought modification now has come through sense perception of the painting, and that painting is now known. I mean, it happens simultaneously, but just to break it down. The vritti comes, the vritti is known. If I look this way, now I can have a memory of that. but I'm not having direct, immediate knowledge of it, right? Because I turned away from it. Now I have direct, immediate knowledge of this vritti, which is known. Now, and that's how knowledge takes place. It involves bringing in a vritti, which as soon as you bring in the vritti, that vritti is illumined. But when the vritti goes away, then that knowledge, that cognition is no longer there. So the object is no longer there as part of your experience. For yourself, that is never true. Your self is not dependent upon a vritti. So the vritti comes of that object, and yourself illumines it. The next vritti comes, yourself is still there illumining it. So your self, which is aparoksha by nature, does not need to be illumined. Right? It's always luminous. So you don't need to gain knowledge of the existence of your being. That's not the problem. The problem is the ignorance which causes you to mistake the existence, your being, causes you to mistake your being to be a guna, a quality of something you're experiencing. Like, my consciousness is a quality of my mind. My mind enjoys consciousness. Right? So consciousness becomes like a guna, a quality of my mind. That's what a jnani thinks. This body, mind, sense organs, consciousness, and existence are qualities of the body, mind, sense organs. That's what's natural. So now, how are we going to recognize who I really am? Because, first of all, who you really are is already there, totally recognized by you in terms of the nature of consciousness and existence per se, but not the limitlessness of it. And so to do that, all of these prakriyas, but the one obvious one is the driktrisha viveka, has to come in to make you realize that, in fact, all of the things that you had taken to be the substantive, having the quality of consciousness, is actually something which can be objectified. Mm-hmm. You see that? Mm. And once it's objectified, then you see that this is coming and going and this isn't. And so we do this strict drisha viveka with every aspect, just starting with the world external to the physical body, because you know that's not you. You don't have a problem there. But then we move in, upadi by upadi, body, sense organs, mind, thoughts, emotions, ahankara, knowledge, ignorance, relationships, any point of identification, you know, anything that can be taken as an upadi. You bring that up to into your experience to now recognize the subject-object, the drik-drisha relationship between the two, leaving in the end only awareness as the drik. And in fact, when you end up with awareness as the drik and you've removed all of the upadis, awareness is no longer a seer, right? Because it doesn't have a mind or sense organs, it is only consciousness. Now you've done this differentiation, and leaving, you're not gaining a new experience. You're removing from your self-experience all of the things that you had mistaken to be you through ignorance. And so, in terms of self-knowledge, we call self-knowledge ajnana nivritti. The removal of ignorance. It's not the gain of something new. It's not the gain of a consciousness vritti. You know, like here, I have a gain of this painting. I have a gain of the painting vritti, and then that becomes known. You're not going to have a vritti of some other consciousness. You're going to have a vritti which differentiates the consciousness which you are. Right? From everything you had taken it to be. So it's actually the removal of ignorance, of ajnanam, right? That then, in the removal of the ajnanam, you are removing the effects of ajnanam, of ignorance, which is this mutual superimposition that we call anyonya adhyasa. You see? And so it's a totally different way of gaining knowledge, because it's gaining knowledge of something which is already there and always there. So you're not gaining anything. There's no gain. right? There's just removal of ignorance that removes the mutual superposition. So here,
and since the closest that we come to that is deep sleep in our in every day.
Well, the closest we come in a sense is deep sleep, because in deep sleep, in the waking state, which enjoys duality and subject-object, and the dream enjoys subject-object duality, the deep sleep doesn't enjoy subject-object duality, which is really important for recognizing that, because in deep sleep you can be without subject-object, awareness can't, your being can't have subject-object. There's no seer seen for awareness.
So awareness can't be found in the creation. It can't be found in duality. It's not to be...
It can't be found in duality as an object. But no, nothing in duality is away from it.
Mm. So, which is interesting, because most modern... I mean, what we think of as modern science is that certain matter actually combines and evolves in a certain way and maybe joins up under certain conditions and consciousness is produced.
Yeah.
But you can say that's what they would naturally say, but what is being produced is an upadhi.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's what makes this...
Yeah.
But I never really got the deeper meaning of this verse.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where it...
That's what they're talking about, yeah. and it's very profound, actually. Because from your standpoint... consciousness and existence are gunas. From your standpoint of an ajnani, they are gunas. Mm-hmm. And now he's saying, no. Mm-hmm. Consciousness is not a guna. It's my very swarupa, right? And if it were a guna, this is the problem that we're looking at, right? Either I don't exist or consciousness doesn't exist, you know? Or it's an object.
So if it would be a guna, then it would come and go, which it doesn't.
Of course, that's another argument. But that's true also. If it's a guna, it's subject to duality and coming and going.
So it's absolutely crazy-making to look for me, myself.
Yeah.
You can't look for yourself.
You cannot look for yourself. This is another... I mean, of course, we're always looking for ourselves because the identification with the mind is so total. You know, and so we're looking at ourselves even in terms of meditative experience, because you're thinking that the mind is traveling or becoming into subtle dimensions... Right. To come into some sort of contact with the self, or coming into a state of being where the self will manifest in it, that type of thing.
Right. And I think that most meditations that are being taught, you want to go, you said, to a different consciousness. You're trying to get to a different level, but you're still keeping
levels
it in the mind.
Consciousness.
I mean, which is all messed up with everything else.
That's right. Now the thing is that in meditation, you can make the mind very, very quiet and get the mind into very subtle and very, very peaceful, deeply peaceful, quiet states of being where the Atma does manifest in that mind. So the mind has this particular experience from its own standpoint of like a very clear water, very, very clear water, how the sun becomes as though... manifest, but really it's the reflection of the sun becoming manifest in that very clear water. For the sun doesn't care if the water is clear or muddy or anything. Nothing's happening to the sun at all. Right? But the mind can assume conditions, or the water can assume conditions where the sun is reverberating through it, which is a very pleasurable experience. Just like the mind becoming deeply, deeply quiet in Savikalpa or Nirvikalpa Samadhi, where it's so quiet that it is not contributing anything really to the self. You know, and so the self is as though totally overwhelmed, that what we call ati sukshma vritti, this very, very, very subtle, sukshma means subtle, ati sukshma, very, very subtle vritti, that is not contributing any type of agitation, no types of namarupa, nothing. It's so, so pure, so quiet. And in such a mind, the self is as though totally manifest in it, or reflected in it, we could say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not knowledge.
Yeah.
That's Nirvikalpa or Savikalpa Samadhi. It's not knowledge. You can come back from that state, and then you say, I just experienced.
Right.
It's not to say it's no value.
No, but it's not to say at all it's of no value. It can be a beacon light, but it also, in a sense, is, you know, like a carrot in front of the donkey.
Yeah.
Yes.
That keeps the donkey moving, right? It just keeps going after that, over, after the carrot.
The wrong thing.
And because the problem is that you take that savikalpa samadhi, which is so profound and which can be a beacon light where you know clearly that there is something very wonderful and profound that exists in this creation, and I want that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I want to always be with it. I want that. I want to always be with it.
Yeah.
And so then I am trying to maintain, to gain, maintain, carry on, have that nirvikalpa or savikalpa experience as much as possible. And the more that I can have it, the more liberated I am. Because there's an identification from the standpoint of the ahankara. Yeah. The identification of the ahankara is with the vritti, not with the self.
Isn't that the big catch? Isn't that the big catch there, that you really think that you are your mind?
That's the catch. Now say if with knowledge you recognize the self as being self-evident, independent, asanga, absolutely as you are, there illumining and pervading every vritti, no matter what. Every vritti, a negative vritti, a painful vritti, a samadhi vritti, all vrittis. You are there, self-evident, in all of those vrittis. That is the Atma. Now, that differentiation has to take place. I have to be able to recognize me illumining the dukkha vritti as well as the sukha vritti. Okay? That's the self. The self is not a state of experience. However, there's nothing certainly, I mean, to practice samadhi, to practice contemplation and all of that is wonderful, especially if you have knowledge, because then what happens is that the mind more and more comes into relationship with your own being and recognizes, learns, becomes habituated to the fact of myself as the source of ananda.
Why it is, you know, whenever we've spoken about samadhi, we have always spoken about it in a, dismissive is not the word, but in a somewhat, as not as a valuable tool. And I'm in the context of mumukshus, why is it not a more valuable tool?
No, it is. I do talk about it. That's why we have meditation. But I'm also very often talking about it in terms of how it's mistaken, because I find that this is this is the thing that stops a person from gaining knowledge.
Yes.
This is where it is, because because you're always determining your knowledge in terms of the vritti. And so it's like this example. You know that I've used this example so many times, but here we go. If the sun is illumining the sky, this is a bright sunny day, right? Then from the standpoint of, say, the person standing on the beach, look at the beautiful, exquisite brilliance of the sun, you know? But then the clouds come, and even though that person will say, I know the sun is there, but I don't experience it, because the clouds are in the way. And if without the clouds, you know, you have all this great logic. This is the person standing on the beach, right? The clouds have come in, dark clouds have come in. Then that person says, well, of course, I know the sun is there, but I don't get to experience it, because the clouds have come in, right? But without the clouds, of course, I mean, without the sun, of course, the clouds couldn't even be seen. It's just that I don't have an experience of the sun. This is how people view knowledge. It's like, I know who I am, and I know that I am there because I'm aware of my vrittis. But since I'm depressed or since I'm sorrowful, you know, I am covered. Myself is covered. And I need for these vrittis, these negative vrittis, to go away so that then I can really yes. see myself. Mm-hmm. Because I get covered by my mind. And so I say, no, this is absolutely not so. The ahankara now is, the self is now identified with a state of mind. When this state of mind is there, I can recognize myself. But when this state of mind is there, I can't. And so now the question is, who are you? Where is the luminosity? Where is the consciousness? You know, is the consciousness some... Where does it exist that it can be covered by a vritti? When I am the one, the self, is the one that's illumining the vritti. So say now there's viveka. There should be viveka between your being and the vritti, which comes and goes. That means that if that viveka is there, that yourself, which is a sangha, you know, which is self-evident, is not at all covered by the vritti, it's illumining the vritti. The vritti doesn't have anything to do with yourself. Both are absolutely present at the same time. The qualities of the vritti are present, and you are present. You're the luminary.
Yeah, and you know, in this vritti also, when it covers your well-being, but also that vritti will start getting agitated that it's lost the well-being also, and how to get back there, you know.
Yeah, but see, now the
double dip there.
Yeah, it goes on and on and on, but this is a problem with ahankara. It's not that you don't want to... Oh, let me put it like this. For somebody who knows, you're always in samadhi. Because no matter what the vritti, yourself is self-evident mm-hmm. in every vritti. Mm-hmm. So in Aparokshanabhuti, at the end of it, Shankara says, what is the sitting in meditation? He's tongue-in-cheek, but you know. Mm-hmm. When am I not? When am I not the self of the vritti? When am I not in samadhi? That's the truth of it. It does not... It doesn't matter what the vritti is in terms of the even the intensity of your own presence there. If you think that the Atma is being revealed to you when a certain vritti is there, then you haven't recognized
yeah.
yourself.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it comes down to, and this is the major problem. Now, on another level, on the level of vrittis, you know, the practice of what we call nididhyasana, which is meditation with knowledge. When we say shravana, manana, nididhyasana, those are what we call upayanishta. These are the means for gaining knowledge. Nididhyasana there is used there for what we call removing the dehatma buddhi. Dehatma buddhi. That conviction that the self is the body. Body, mind, sense, organs. That's what the nididhyasana does. It helps the mind in that act of meditation to recognize, come into relationship, so to speak, with my own presence. It recognizes that. Another thing it recognizes is that the ananda that I experience in the mind when the mind is quiet mm-hmm. is in no way dependent upon any object. Mm-hmm. That it is me, the self, that is responsible for that experience of ananda in the mind. Now, this is another subtle thing. We all want to be happy. So within samsara, we know happiness as something that we acquire through the fulfillment of a desire. So we know that happiness is an experience. We are taught, or it's passed down to us somehow in the West, that moksha is the extreme happiness, the end of the line of happiness.
Yeah.
And so then what do we think? We think of the happiest vrittis, the happiest experiences we've ever had, which are mental states, because they come and go. Right, so your very happiest experiences are these few mental states that you remember that you've had. And then you think, And so moksha is going to be 1,000 times that mental state. Yeah. Right?
Like somehow this big sunlight is going to come on and that'll stay on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But those mental states, even if they're savikalpa samadhi, are states that come and go. Mental states come and go. The ananda of the self cannot be equated with a mental state, a state of mind, a vritti. Those happy vrittis point to the ananda of yourself, which is different than the variegated ananda mental states.
The anandas are different qualities.
It's a different quality because the ananda or the wholeness or fullness of yourself never comes and goes. Mm. Once it's recognized, then you say, we'll say something like this to yourself, ah, that's what they mean by ananda. Mm. The ananda, which is natural to my own being, that infinite wholeness, which is the very swarupa of me, of the self, that is there. No, it's never covered by any vritti. It doesn't matter the quality of the vritti. Whereas within, from the standpoint of the vrittis, you have the most extreme, painful, hurt, negative vrittis all the way up to savikalpa, nirvikalpa, samadhi vrittis. Right? And so there's a continuum of from heaven to hell, you know, in terms of the experiences that the mind is capable of giving you. But through that whole variety from, you know, here we've got hell over here all the way up to heaven, in terms of mental states, my ananda is never touched at all. Now, that doesn't mean that we want, from the standpoint of this body-mind-sense organs, to have negative vrittis. We'd rather have positive vrittis because they're more resonant with my nature. But for a jnani, I am that all the time. I am that wholeness all the time. It's not waxing and waning. It's not waxing and waning. Then you should use your dukkha vrittis, your sorrowful states, to recognize yourself in the presence of that dukkha vritti. Then see that nothing has happened to you at all, and not anything. Nevertheless, you want to get rid of the dukkha vritti. That's different.
That's that double dip I'm talking about.
Well, the double dip on one end, even for a jnani, if things are causing you pain, or hurting you, that's a sadhana. It means your mind is, either there's a lack of vairagya there, or there's inner child work and trauma, things that have to be worked on. It's just like if your body is hurting, you have to work on it. You know, you can say, well, it's not hurting me, the self. Yeah, but it's, I've got this body and this body's hurting. Yeah, I've got this mind is hurting me. So it's natural for the upadhi to remove pain, you know. So that's a different issue. Uh-huh. So again, this isn't at all an attack on nitya dhyasana. Nitya dhyasana for us involves knowledge. You know, we're not doing nitya dhyasana on something we don't know. Mm-hmm. We're doing nitya dhyasana on what we do know, and for that's extremely valuable because what you your mind continues to learn is that I am the truth of every vritti. And this truth that I am is really the cause of any experience of ananda that the mind enjoys. The objects of desire are an illusory in that when I fulfill a desire, my mind becomes quiet. That's what happens when you fulfill a desire. At that moment, you're desireless. And the mind takes on a shanta vritti. And in that shanti, the mind, you know, naturally reflects me, you know, in its own way. Not that I'm not, the reflection, it reflects as the experience of ananda in the mind. The ananda that's illumining the mind is always exactly the same and ever present. It's not like the mind is giving me a little peek of ananda. No, that ananda is a vritti in the mind. Vritti ananda. It's different than me, the wholeness that's illumining the vritti.
Well, we can pray.
That's what we don't know.
We can pray for these shanta vrittis. I mean, you know, they say, you know, when you go to Ganapati,
you can pray for antakarana shuddhi. But you're praying for what I would suggest. You can pray for antakarana shuddhi, but that's not the end. You want antakarana shuddhi so you can gain knowledge.
Yeah.
So that you can recognize yourself as someone who is free of all of this sukha and dukkha and dharma, adharma, and all of these things, you don't have anything to do with that. You're free. Your being is free. It can't become an adharmi, and it can't become a dharmi. It can't become a sukhi. It can't become a dukkhi. It's a dvaita. It's always the same. That's the freedom. If you're in samsara, then sometimes you're a sukhi, sometimes you're a dukkhi, sometimes you're a dharmi, and now some adharma slipped in. You're always paying a price. You know, that's the nature of samsara. Moksha is a freedom from that. And even with moksha, the body, mind, sense organs are still bound by dharma, adharma, the experience of sukha and dukkha. Those experiences still remain. You know, basically.
Because that's the arrangement in this loka.
Right? That's right. Though.
It's my secret.
That's the arrangement within duality. Though, you, in spite of your prarabdha, in spite of the negative experiences that come your way and will come your way, because of your freedom, because of your recognition of yourself, you can accept those things and just deal with them objectively. It's not that you say, oh, this is not this very difficult situation. Oh, it's not difficult. It is a difficult situation that you're dealing with objectively. You don't feel like your ananda is at stake, not because you're conditioned to not, you've talked yourself into that. It's because of the viveka, nothing is happening to you. If something were happening to you, then you'd be lying, you know? It's like, oh, nothing's really happening to me, the self that I don't know. But because of viveka, you recognize that in spite of all of this difficulty, nothing is happening to me. That's your experience.
This is the asangaham, right? I mean, the asangaha.
Yes, the asangatvam of the self. We have to be careful with the asanga. Swamiji is even in his lectures, I mean in our dialogues on the homepage. He said one point, he says, asanga, you know, I'm not asanga. This is very difficult. You know, that puts you in a position where, and how the standpoint he was coming from is, oh, asanga, I have no attachment to any of this. Which is true. But then you can't, at the same time you have no attachment to any of this, at the same time you are all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, like the clay has no attachment to the pot, but it is the pot. Mm-hmm. So you're asanga to all of this. Nothing ever happens to you, but at the same time you are all of this. Mm-hmm. So he didn't want that type of division, whereas though you escape into the asanga atma and leave the creation.
No, I didn't mean it that way.
No, I know, but that's, I was just thinking in terms of that word asanga. You have to understand asanga in terms of satya mitya. Mm-hmm. You know, where the pot is the clay, but the clay is not the pot. This whole universe is me, but I am totally free of the universe. And that is your direct, immediate experience, the aparoksha jnanam. So aparoksha jnanam is the direct, immediate recognition of the changelessness of my being, the satya mitya.
I found it really helpful, like that you said, like because these deep samadhi states, if you don't have that knowledge at the same time, I fully got stuck.
Yeah.
You know, and you become the donkey, and that's really like you run around. You think you have something, but you know.
And then you try to hang on to it, and then you have to go meditate again, and you don't get it that time, and you know. Yeah.
Well, should you expect to be able to? This is just a off the wall remark. Should you be able to expect to?
We're shocked, isn't it?
Oh.
No, come on. You're doing good.
You to have well-being and wholeness, and at the same time immersed in this change that's taking place that's unpleasant. I mean.
Yeah, see, that's where.
There's a trick there, huh?
That's where when you find yourself getting caught in the samsara, that samsara becomes a sadhana to you, because actually you should be able to pull your mind back from that and then objectively deal with it. You pull your mind back to your knowledge, you know, and then objectively deal with it. And if you're not able to do that, then inner child work comes in. And
well, can't you let both simultaneously exist? I mean,
if it doesn't bother you.
Oh, it does.
Well, if it's bothering you and you don't mind being bothered, You know, but if you mind the bother, yeah. Say you're being bothered and twisted by it, and you say, okay, I'm being bothered and twisted by it, that's the creation, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
And so behind the botheredness and twisted, you accept that you're fine, because yourself is there and it's no problem. But that's usually not what's going on. Usually you're bothered and twisted and in pain.
Yeah.
And then what you want to do is do based upon all of the things that we've learned. Like if it's something you can blow away, then you just say, I'm Brahman, right? It's like smoke.
Okay.
Or you have to do a little bit more work with it. And that can involve all the inner child work, all of the different things that we've worked with, because it could be an unconscious part just overwhelming you. Then it needs to be healed. And you're not going to tell a little baby you're Brahman. You know, you have to hold the baby, you know. And so some type of different levels of work are necessary. Sometimes, and it can be, it could just be doing japa, or it could be doing inner child work, or it could just be bringing your knowledge to the forefront just with a statement.
Uh-huh.
It can be so many different things.
But bringing your knowledge to the forefront with a statement, isn't that still some sort of a meditation, though?
In a sense, but it's instantaneous. Like, for instance, say the problem is not that big, and then you just say something like, something like Ishwara Oham, I'm Ishwara, I'm Brahman, or whatever it is, but that statement is not just a statement.
Mm-hmm. It's something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The statement brings to mind, you would even say Om. So Om used to say Hari Om Tat Sat. Because it meant something, you know.
Yeah.
You can just say something that means something to you, and it can be more words, it could be one word, just whatever brings your knowledge back, that could be enough. Or maybe you have to sit and contemplate on it for a while. Like, say you have a strong desire, and that desire is not being fulfilled in some way. You have to spend time and sit with that and be with it. That's just another way of bringing yourself back to knowledge. Now, say it's a little child with inner child work. You have to sit with that child part on its own level. You know, and make it feel held and loved. And you may have to do that over some time until it integrates with the adult. And that's what needs to be done to take care of that part. There's nothing wrong in that. I mean, we do that in the outside world all of the time. You know, you take care of whoever's having a problem. I'm doing that with my little Tibby all the time.
Do you think that there comes an end to that, or is that just a kind of lifelong thing for the jiva?
You know what? Many things come to an end because they mature and mature. You're there.
Yeah.
Many things do come to an end. You outgrow them, you let them go, you know? And some things don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some things need tending. Because they're what? Some air tips, she might be.
Girl, what are you doing?
We love you.
She likes to be dried off, and now it's sunny, but she still likes to be dried off.
She likes the touch.
Yeah. She likes to be dried off even when she's not wet.
Yeah.
Not tips.
No, she's been in the bushes, that's why she's wet.
Oh, she's a little bit wet.
Oh.
She wants some food. Anyway, we're done, aren't we? Did I leave something out?
Well, yeah. I just don't want to kind of have to anticipate, well, this is going to go on, you know, until I die or whether...
What I would say is that there's structures in the mind because of things that happened in childhood that can be there as kind of a scar tissue.
Yeah.
Where your mind has a propensity to go into this direction, but it's lost a lot, all of its redness and pussiness, mm-hmm. that's all gone, but it mm-hmm. has the... that tendency, but it's much easier to just, you know, how to care for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so... Doesn't have the same grip, mm-hmm. even if it doesn't completely mm-hmm. go away. But the thing is, it's much different than when something, you know, you don't have any knowledge and the thing is really mm-hmm. hurting you as to when that type of tendency of thought is there, mm-hmm. you know, which your buddhi is in is much stronger than the tendency of thinking. When your buddhi is much stronger than that tendency, the tendency doesn't overwhelm the buddhi, so the buddhi can hold it and handle it without losing all of its shanti. You know, so that that way, painful way of thinking comes into a buddhi that's much stronger than it, so that can hold it. And you don't feel, you're not overwhelmed by the, you're not overwhelmed by the, yeah, by the problem.
Yeah, that works. Thank you.
I think sometimes just being a little bit, having the ability to, at least, to be a little bit more patient with it.
Yeah.
Even if you are overwhelmed, going, okay.
Exactly. Patient and kind.
Yeah. Carol, the thing is, every time, you know, we say something like, you can recognize you are Brahman. That you that is being spoken to is the mind, really not the Brahman at all. Really not Brahman
right.
at all.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that the language is clearer if you say, well, you recognize you are the mind. You know what I mean? It's a, you're
yeah, but there's
the
a
mind.
Problem there, Kiki, because this is the Satya Mitya, you know. The you is always Brahman, the you, the truth of the you. But when there's any type of thinking or talking, that's we're using the upadhi there. Like if I say, you recognize you, you are Brahman, right? So think like this, say the pot has to recognize I am clay. Because in fact, the pot is clay,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the mind has to recognize I am Brahman. Right, the mind has to recognize I am Brahman. Because it is Brahman, but when it recognizes I am Brahman, it's recognizing, knowing the meaning of Brahman, it's recognizing that itself, its very self, is free. You see what I mean? Brahman is free. Brahman is non-dual. If the mind says, I am Brahman, it can no longer take the I to be the mind. Mm-hmm. It's recognizing that its I is Brahman.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Om. Let's say our prayer. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.